Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Police in New York are appealing to the public for information after an explosion in the Manhattan neighborhood of Chelsea injured 29 people late Saturday. Authorities call the blast an intentional act. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo labeled the incident an act of terrorism at a news conference on Sunday morning, but specified that there's no evidence of international terrorism.
A bomb going off is generically a terrorist activity. That's how we're going to consider it, and that's how we will prosecute it also.
At a news conference in New York later Sunday, the city's mayor, Bill de Blasio, called the explosion a bombing, but declined to go as far as the governor in labeling the blast terrorism. Cuomo said an additional 1,000 police and National Guard troops will be patrolling the city's public transportation system. City officials say all 29 victims injured in the blast have been released from the hospital. The bomb detonated in a bustling neighborhood filled with bars, restaurants, and residences during an especially busy time for the city as world leaders arrive in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly this week. 17 Indian soldiers have been killed and nearly 20 wounded in the deadliest attack mounted by militants in two decades on an Indian Army base in Kashmir close to the border with Pakistan. Officials say four heavily armed commandos using guns and grenades stormed the army camp early Sunday in Uri, which lies west of Indian Kashmir's capital, Srinagar. An army statement said four militants were killed. This is VOA News. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations blasted Russia for calling the U.N. Security Council into emergency session late Saturday to review an apparently errant U.S. bombing run which may have killed dozens of Syrian government troops. Samantha Power said Russia's action was a stunt designed to divert public attention from some of the most systematic atrocities in a generation. A senior Somali military official was killed in a car bomb explosion in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, on Sunday. A spokesman for the Mogadishu Regional Administration told VOA General Mohamed Robla Jamali, a.k.a. Gubale, and six of his bodyguards died when their convoy was hit by a car loaded with explosives near the entrance of Somalia's Ministry of Defense headquarters in Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. The general was the head of the 3rd Battalion of the Somali Army and was also a leading officer in the fight against the Somali militant group. An Islamic State-run news agency said that the stabbing attack in a shopping mall in the U.S. state of Minnesota Saturday was carried out by a soldier of the Islamic State. The Amaq news agency claimed Sunday that the suspect had heeded the group's calls for attacks in countries that are part of a U.S.-led anti-IS coalition. U.S. officials have not commented on the claim. Minnesota authorities said eight people were wounded in the shopping mall stabbing attack in St. Cloud. Police Chief William Blair Anderson said an off-duty police officer shot and killed the suspect. Anderson said all but one of the victims had been released from the hospital and that none of them had life-threatening wounds. Russians are voting to choose a new parliament. Charles Maines reports for VOA from Moscow.
The last time Russia held parliamentary elections, in 2011, opposition parties were banned from participating, and amid evidence of widespread vote rigging, tens of thousands took to the streets in protest, the biggest public challenge Vladimir Putin has faced in his 17 years in power. Political analyst Nikolai Petrov says the Kremlin has learned its lesson.
The Kremlin is not eager to practice large-scale fraud. It's eager to avoid any scandals, to avoid any threat of mass protests.
Kremlin officials say these elections are different. There have been raucous televised debates. A respected human rights campaigner now runs the election commission. And international observers from the OSCE are on hand to monitor the vote. There are also more parties, 15. Charles Maines, VOA News, Moscow.
I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Investing in people, creating jobs, building a strong, resilient economy, and then governing in an open, honest, and transparent manner.
The Ghanaian ruling party, the National Democratic Congress, unveils a manifesto ahead of the December 7 elections.
Today, the police, together with the militia, dispersed the people, disrupted the demonstrations in Kwazana, Dwarasekwa, Fakose, Epweth, and Kambuzuma. Live ammunition was fired.
The Zimbabwean police dismissed reports of using live ammunition to disperse an anti-government protest.
The main objective of the conference is to provide epidemiological updates on the state of African immigrant health.
And the fourth U.S. conference on the African immigrant health ends in New York Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Ghanaian ruling National Democratic Congress, or NDC, officially unveiled its manifesto in the Bono Ahafo regional capital, Sunyani, on Saturday. But opposition groups criticized the manifesto, saying it shows the government has failed to deliver on its previous promises. For more on the promises of the ruling party to Ghanaians ahead of the December 7 general election, I reached Kwaku Anyidoho, the Deputy General Secretary of the NDC.
Basically, looking at four thematic areas: investing in people, creating jobs, building a strong, resilient economy, and then governing in an open, honest, and transparent manner. Now, what we did also was to apply a lot of evidence-based approach. What it is that we have been able to do, what it is that we are doing, and what it is that we intend to do. So it's not about highfalutin promises. It's not about pretending that we have worked. It's about what Ghanaians have given us the opportunity to do, what we have done, and what we intend to do. Peter.
A section of the Ghanaian population said that the NDC's promises in its manifesto 4 years ago, significant sections of it were not necessarily kept, and that this will be the same thing. What is your take about this criticism?
All I know is that it is the New Patriotic Party that continues to speak as if they are speaking on behalf of a significant portion of Ghanaians. Peter, if you take investing in people, if you take the issue of infrastructure expansion, and if you look at the heavy investment that we have done in the areas of expanding healthcare, creating more healthcare institutions, if you take education, elimination of schools under trees, creating more schools at the secondary level, community-based secondary schools. If you come to the tertiary level, that we are creating more public universities to allow more people to have access to public education at the tertiary level for much, 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 much cheaper than what the private universities offer. If you take the heavy investment in the road sector. Now, if you take the fact that today, Ghana has walked out of darkness significantly. And so a lot of investment has gone into creating a power generation capacity that is far in excess of our consumption capacity. So we won't go back to the dark days of Dumso any longer. That is how you build an economy. So what we have done between President Mills and President Mahama is to create the necessary infrastructure for takeoff into real growth and development.
I was listening to some members of the main opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, and they claim that the manifesto of the NDC is basically their ideas, and these were photocopies or stolen ideas from the NPP. What is your reaction to that?
I mean, Peter, aren't they making a mockery of themselves? You claim that you are hiding your manifesto, and then when you bring the manifesto out, the NDC will copy. The NDC has gone ahead and put out its manifesto. You still haven't put out yours, but you claim that it has been plagiarized. Peter, who plagiarizes a document that is in the head of an individual and has not been put into print? So they don't even understand the meaning of the word plagiarism. Ghanaians are serious. Ghanaians have become listening. And I can tell you, Peter, that press conference held claiming that we've stolen their ideas is making them lose a lot of energy on the ground because people don't take them serious any longer in Ghana.
What do you think are the prospects of the chances of President John Dramani Mahama of winning re-election come December 7?
Well, Peter, if you look at the extent to which the NDC is united behind our leader, President Mahama, if you look at the extent to which the NDC is showcasing unity, cohesion, a common sense of purpose, majority of Ghanaians are looking at the NDC and President Mahama as a serious political party with a serious political leader as compared to the NPP. There's no unity. They are in sixes and sevens. They sack their chairman. They sack their general secretary. And then you have a flag bearer who is going on a heavy, unrealistic, promising spree. He's going to build one factory in every district within 1 year. He's going to put up a dam in every village within 1 year. They're going to go around distributing $1 million to every constituency as if they were at a wedding, distributing confetti. And Ghanaians have no respect for them any longer. We want a serious government. We want a serious president, a truthful president, and not people who lie just for the sake of wanting political power.
Kwaku Anyidoho is the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghanaian ruling National Democratic Congress, NDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The rebuilding infrastructure legislation to sustain enduring peace in South Sudan was introduced Thursday in the U.S. Congress. One U.S. lawmaker says she hopes her colleagues focus on rebuilding South Sudan now so that when peace and stability finally return to the country, the U.S. will be better positioned to help. The bill's authors said it could pave the way for some 500 former lost boys and girls to return to South Sudan to help rebuild their war-ravaged country, rather. For VOA, Ian Bior reports from Washington.
The bill is now before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, where lawmakers are reviewing it and deciding whether to vote it out of committee so it can be debated by the full House. Democrat Karen Bass from the West Coast state of California is urging her colleagues to vote in favor of the bill because it is consistent with the ongoing work the U.S. government is doing on behalf of the people of South Sudan.
You should know this is not the only thing that's happening around South Sudan. We're talking about this right now. There's other legislative efforts that we're looking at. But in my opinion, focusing on people here returning home is exactly what we should be doing. You don't just want to, and this is what Congress typically does, Congress focuses on putting out fires. We want to focus on building.
Bass knows that it could take months, sometimes even years, before a bill becomes law. A clause in the bill states that the State Department must declare that South Sudan is safe enough for the former lost boys and girls to return in order for them to do their work. Mayom Bulachuk, a former lost boy who came to the U.S. in late 2000, says he thinks the bill could open up more options for people like him who are eager to go back.
I thought like that would be the best way to go and reconnect with the land and with the people in South Sudan since I left at the younger age.
Bull returned to South Sudan in 2013 after earning two master's degrees, one in Christian leadership and the other in international development at Eastern University in the town of St. David's, located in the East Coast state of Pennsylvania. Bull says he wanted to use both degrees and experience toward helping South Sudanese citizens, but before he could do that, the conflict erupted in late 2013. The United States eventually evacuated citizens, including Bull himself. Despite fears of insecurity, Bull remains hopeful this time around because the bill introduced this week will make a difference. Apajo Dao Deng, who was just 15 years old when she came to the United States in 2000, lives and works as a banker in Richmond, Virginia, about 2 hours' drive time south of Washington, D.C. She says she wants to go back to South Sudan to mentor and encourage young women.
We need as much educated women as possible. You know, we need to educate women that is not just only to get married as soon as they turn 16, but follow what's your life, you know, what you're supposed to do or what your life will be.
Jacob Rye, another former lost boy who received a certificate in information technology at a training facility called New Horizons in Pennsylvania, says he wants to go back to teach South Sudanese how to use computers. He says he knows that the bill has a long way to go before it becomes law, but he is convinced that providing transportation for South Sudanese diaspora to go back to their home country is the best way to help develop South Sudan.
And you can build a country based on just only physical infrastructure. You do need, you know, human capital, but we are part of that community, and we hope and we feel that we can contribute, you know, like other people back home. And most of us here do believe that if we go back, then we will build the country that way.
If a majority of lawmakers on the House Foreign Affairs Committee approve the bill and it passes in the full House, the legislation will be referred to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, where it will move through the same process, and if approved, will land on the president's desk for signature. Bass says she expects it will take several months for the process to move forward. In the meantime, she's hoping peace returns to South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The Zimbabwean police have dismissed reports that it used live ammunition in downtown Harare to disperse an anti-government protest Saturday. For VOA, Sebastian Mhofu has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
A coalition of opposition parties said Zimbabwean police used live bullets to disperse protesters demonstrating against President Robert Mugabe, resulting in injuries and arrest. The non-profit group Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights confirmed in a tweet that dozens have been arrested. Here is Douglas Munzora, the spokesman of Zimbabwe's coalition of opposition parties.
Today, the police together with the militia dispersed the people, disrupted the demonstrations in Kwazana, Dziwarasekwa, Mfakose, Epworth, and Kambuzuma. Live ammunition was fired from a truck which was being used by the police and the militia, and as a result, two people were injured as a direct result of the shooting. We have right now more than 20 people who are at Avenues Clinic who are receiving treatment. Over 100 people have been arrested throughout the country. Some of these people include members of parliament.
Zimbabwe has been rocked by an unprecedented wave of protests since July, calling on President Mugabe to fix the economy and respect human rights. In a telephone interview Saturday, Zimbabwe police spokesman Paul Nyati denied that his organization used live bullets to disperse protesters.
That's a false statement. Evidence on the ground, and which anyone can conclusively confirm, there is no live bullets which have been used by the police. And whoever is making such allegations should come forward and prove the so-called allegations.
The Saturday demonstration was organized by a coalition of Zimbabwe's opposition parties. Munzara said protests would continue until President Mugabe fixes the economy and respects human rights or quits leading Zimbabwe, which has been doing for the past 36 years. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Meanwhile, the Zimbabwean Central Bank says the country will introduce bond notes to the mix of currencies used by consumers by the end of October. 6 years ago, Zimbabwe had an inflation rate of over 200 million%. Since then, it has relied on the US dollar and the South African rand as local currencies. John Robertson is an economist and consultant in Harare. Viewers William Eagle asked him why the bonds are being introduced now.
That's a difficult question because it's really just to treat the symptoms of the problem, and the symptoms are that we lack the cash. As a developing country, we are a bit of an exception in the world because countries that want to earn hard currency would normally have to deal with strong economies, but here in Zimbabwe you can earn US dollars by having something to sell to the Zimbabwean population. And the US dollars are very popular in China and India and other countries. And so the shipment of US dollars out of the country in physical notes has caused a massive cash scarcity. But that's been worsened by the fact that we have a huge trade deficit. And that's because we've closed down most of our productive sectors. Manufacturing and agriculture are nearly dead. The mining sector is sort of functioning, but not very well. But the main thing is that we used to produce most of the consumer goods we required, and today we're importing them. So we're sending money out of the country to pay for them. And obviously, over a period, this has drained the resources we've had. It's drained the money we've earned from exports. It's drained our savings. And now we've got very little left. So the US dollars we can collect from a bank every day are rationed. And that scarcity is something they're trying to overcome with the bond notes, because they are right in thinking that nobody outside the country is going to want to take bond notes out of Zimbabwe. So these will remain here.
In fact, the government once before had used bond notes, did it not, in 2009 when you had, I believe, over 200% inflation. Could that possibly happen again with these new notes?
Well, it could do. In those days, of course, it was the Zimbabwe dollar we had. We ruined the Zimbabwe dollar by printing many hundreds of trillions of them. And, of course, we destroyed the value. That is because government couldn't raise the money it needed to meet its tax obligations and its expenditures. So they just simply decided to print more. And that's always been the case in history. If you print more money than your money supply can actually handle, the value will go down. And we came close to breaking the world record for inflation. Now, it could happen with these if they were to print a very large quantity of them. The government is claiming at the moment that they will not increase the print order above $200 million worth of bond notes. At that rate, it's not a big sum of money spread amongst the population of 14 million Zimbabweans. It'll be less than a dollar per person per month. But if they hold the print order to only $200 million, and it takes another year to get into circulation, I think that's not going to place an enormous risk of a value collapse. But whether we can trust the government to restrain themselves and not print any more of these notes, that is the real question.
If the bond notes are indeed released at the end of October, what effect would it have on ordinary Zimbabweans, that is, consumers?
The bond notes that they're issuing will not be useful for paying for imported goods. We really have to pay for those with US dollars or rand or foreign currency. And so nobody will be able to replace the stock they're selling if they are paid bond notes. And that would apply to the fuel as well. So we're buying gasoline, we'll not be able to do so if they're offering bond notes and the service stations are unable to use those notes to replace the stock. I think it is going to lead to scarcities. Food items make up more than 30% of normal spending. So whether you're talking about the industry or the milling industry or the people doing canned goods or bottles of tomato ketchup or soft drinks, the quantities that are available today from what's left of the farming sector is just not enough. We do have more farmers on the land, but they cannot produce. And that's another of the issues. The farmers themselves have no access to money because the land was taken off the market and the land can no longer be used as security for bank loans. So the farmers have been disabled. They are new farmers with little experience in the first place, but they've not been able to function properly because the financing arrangements that used to be very robust and very effective in Zimbabwe, they've been destroyed by the land reform program, which effectively nationalized the land and said all of it now belongs to the government and it cannot be used as collateral for bank loans.
That was economist John Robertson. He spoke with viewers William Eagle from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The The fourth U.S. Conference on the African Immigrant Health ends Sunday in New York. Officials at the U.S. Health and Human Services, organizers of the event, say the conference seeks to apply a health behavior and change framework specific to the African immigrant community. For more about realizing the objectives of the conference, I reached Dr. Emmanuel Koku, associate professor at Drexel University and one of the organizers of the conference.
The main objective of the conference is to provide epidemiological updates on the state of African immigrant health. And the second objective is also to provide examples of best practices that caseworkers, that interventionists, and that researchers use in addressing immigrant health problems. And the third is to provide a resource also for all those workers dealing with African immigrant health issues so that they will better know how to best address them.
What was the reaction of the participants, and what have you seen so far on realizing of this objective today?
Well, the participants are very, very much excited about this, because in the USA here, there are very, very few resources that provide this type of avenue at a very national level. Most of what we have goes on at the local level. So the purpose of this conference is to bring all these local people together from various sectors. People came all as far as Seattle, from Washington State, from Maine, all of them together to share their experiences and to figure out and chart a way to move forward in addressing immigrant health issues. So people have been very much excited. One of the unique features of this particular conference is what we call the town hall format, where we bring together people in a very open forum for them to address questions, to ask questions, to seek answers, and discuss topics ranging from hypertension, diabetes, HIV, cancer, and research, so that people could better know how to address these problems at a very micro level.
Now, looking forward, particularly with reference to the conclusions of the path forward, what are some of the measures that will be adopted and will be implemented to make it successful?
One of the things we are thinking about is forming what we call a African Immigrant Health Partnership. And by partnership, we mean a collaboration between those working in the African health sector and allied sectors. Because if you look at the concept called social determinants of health, health does not exist in a vacuum. It is related to many, many other aspects of a person's life: economic, race, structural, social, and so on and so forth. So we hope to engage in all these other multiple sectors to address African immigrant health. And we also hope to collaborate with various national and local agencies that help to improve African health issues.
Are there any tools being discussed that would help with actualizing the conclusions reached at this conference?
Right now, at this particular point, we are engaging in capacity building. So one of the issues that we are dealing with right now is to help local agencies regarding how to conduct better needs assessments of the various programs that they are doing. So we are helping members develop questionnaires. We are helping members learn how to conduct focus groups. We are helping members learn how to develop indicators, how to measure the success of the various programs that they have measured. And we hope to be able to disseminate these kinds of information to the local community. Another tool that we have developed is what we call the anti-stigma curriculum. And if you recall very well, HIV stigma is a huge problem in our community. And it prevents people from seeking access. It prevents people from testing for HIV. It prevents people, or makes it difficult for people, to remain in care, even if they know they are infected. The challenge becomes, how do we educate our care providers, institutions, even the community, to deal with HIV stigma? That has been a challenge, particularly with the African immigrant population. And so we developed this, and we have pre-tested it, and it's available to local organizations and also any community health centers or any providers who deal with large African immigrant populations. So that is a tool that we have available that we can also give out to people who are interested in it.
Dr. Emmanuel Koku is an associate professor at Drexel University and one of the organizers of the conference. He spoke with me from New York. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. And let's begin with football. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel were held to a 1-1 draw by visiting the TP Mazembe of DR Congo in the first leg of their Confederation Cup semi-final on Saturday. The Confederation Cup holders took the lead after 19 minutes when a Hamza Lahma free kick found a way through the Mazembe wall. Last year's Africa Champions League's winners, Mazembe, scored an important away goal 6 minutes after halftime through Ivorian Roger Asale. The other semi-final first leg is on Sunday as Algeria's Mamelodi Bajaye hosts FUS Rabat of Morocco. Etoile and Mazembe have won 9 African titles each. FUS Rabat won the tournament in 2010, leaving Bajaye chasing a first-ever continental title. And it's a strong defense versus formidable attack between first-time semi-finalist Mamelodi Bajaye and FUS Rabat. Bajaye have conceded only 3 goals, all away from home, in 8 matches en route to the semi-final stage. FUS, the only semi-finalists who did not begin this season in the Champions League, have struck 23 goals in 12 games. In the African Champions League, Zesco United of Zambia beat Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa 2-1 in Indola on Saturday in the first leg of the semi-final. The Zambians will take a narrow advantage into the second leg, with the South Africans securing what could prove to be a crucial away goal. In only the second Champions League semi-final involving clubs from Southern Africa, it was Zesco United who took the lead with 2 goals in 2 minutes from Jackson Mwanza. On Friday, Zamalek took a big step towards the final with a 4-0 win over Wydad Casablanca in Alexandria. A wonder goal by Shikabala set up Zamalek of Egypt thrash Wydad Casablanca of Morocco 4-1 in Alexandria, a match which proved to be John Toshak's last as coach of the Moroccan side. It was a record Champions League semi-final winning margin for Zamalek, bettering the 3-0 home triumph over JET of Algeria in 1984. The second leg of the semi-finals will be played on Saturday, September 24th. Meanwhile, South Africa's FA, SATA, will on Wednesday decide whether to keep Ephraim Sheikh's Mashaba as Bafana Bafana coach. Mashaba's position has been the subject of speculation after South Africa failed to qualify for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon. Danny Jordan, South Africa's SAFA's president, is reported to have said Mashaba's future will be discussed at its next executive committee meeting. It's possible that a new coach could be appointed before South Africa's opening 2018 World Cup qualifier away to Burkina Faso in Ouagadougou in October. South Africa placed in Group D of World Cup qualifying and faced a tough home encounter against the Teranga Lions of Senegal in their second match in November. Cape Verde make up the standings. And in athletics, Ethiopia's Mekwanta Anyenu and Meseret Mengistu claimed the men's and women's titles respectively at the 36th edition of Beijing Marathon, an IAAF gold label road race on Saturday. As the fastest woman on paper in the field, the 26-year-old Mengistu lived up to expectations. She outraced compatriot Malcolm Gizao to win in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 56 seconds. It's Mengistu's first title over the classic distance in 17 months after her big breakthrough last year when she smashed her personal best by nearly 6 minutes to win the 2015 Paris Marathon in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 26 seconds. The men's race was also decided after the 40-kilometer mark, but the winning time was relatively slow compared to the women's race. The 24-year-old Ayenu stunned a field that included 8 sub-2-hour, 10-minute runners to win in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 9 seconds. Finally, James Mwangi Wangari of Kenya clocked the second fastest time in the world this year at the Copenhagen Half Marathon, an IAAF Silver Label road race on Sunday. In just his second race over the distance, the 22-year-old Kenyan reached the finish line in 59.07, knocking 7 seconds from the course record set last year by compatriot Bedan Karochi. Karochi was in the race looking to defend his title, but couldn't keep up with Wangari's aggressive early race front running. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Girl, I'm drowning in your love. Yeah. So baby, take it all. I know with you no turning back. Girl, I said it all. I don't care what people say about you. Don't care if they must spoil you from you. Because a good old lullaby, kuwewa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubt in a fit mess up to Hassami Nabu. Show my true friend in me, my love. Oh, no, go to Roma, no. Go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Baby, oh, baby, oh, girl, I just want you to know. Another man bore you out, baby. No go chop another woman, no how. Ooh. Feeling I'm feeling for you, baby, is awakening my soul. I will love you till nobody else see what they won't do for you. Why? Yeah, you no go regret. Nothing go make me forget. Only you are no good to share. Cause a good old lullaby, I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubt in a fit mess up to Hassan in the boot. Show my true me, my love. Oh, no, go to Roma, no. Yeah, go to Boca, go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Baby, oh, baby, oh, girl, I just want you to know.
Jumbo,
no more. Amaka, you know, Kwamo Yoruba lemio. Ika papa no want us to marry. Yo, woma lo yo yo yo. No, girl, I'm down for you, no, for God. Me love me, I get it for you. Amma, no go compare. Me, myself, for my girl. Yeah, yeah. Baby broke as long as you love me. Girl, I dare ya. Girl, I dare ya. Pray for me. Oh, no, if I know what's wrong. But then, your father is violent. Holy day. Holy Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Girl, I don't define that. Your mother is black dot. She's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I bet you that. Your father is violent. Oh, let me tell you. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. We'll be fine, mommy. Your mother is black belt. She's a real character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I know this song. No more.
Yeah. want to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my lover now? What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. Cause now you are defined. Baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover? Or love for four. This guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover? No, I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who Jay face. All this time you there with, she gon' make me crazy. Why would you be my lover? Magic cruise. Wanna know if you go do. I got one question for you. Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Baby, oh.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. A line in William Burns' lyric states, "Truth crushed to earth shall rise again." This is an appropriate reminder in light of what has been going on in the United States in the current campaign for the presidency. A narrative has been formulated which states that the Democratic candidate, former Secretary Clinton, conceived the idea of Libyan intervention and was able to convince or coerce President Obama to intervene in Libya, and that the current political and security mess that now exists in Libya should be placed at the doorsteps. What is surprising is that none of the major media has been able to debunk this erroneous narrative. Now, last week, on the 14th of September to be precise, A report has been published by the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee entitled Libya, Examination of Intervention and Collapse and United Kingdom's Future Policy Options. The real fact is that the prime mover for the Libyan intervention were France and Great Britain. In fact, at the time, around March 2011, President Obama was widely criticized, not only in the United States, but in Europe, of leading from behind, which means he was very reluctant to intervene in the Libyan case. It is also true that former President Sarkozy of France was the major architect of the Libyan intervention and regime change. When the president of Tunisia was ousted at the beginning of what became known as the Arab Spring, he was widely criticized for his very cozy relations with the ousted president of Tunisia. Perhaps to cover up his track, he turned his attention with vengeance to Libya, and he was joined by Prime Minister Cameron of the United Kingdom. We must also bear in mind that the Security Council, which adopted the no-fly resolution, was also brought into the picture by France and the United Kingdom. They were the ones who mobilized the Gulf Cooperation Council to request the Arab League for a no-fly zone and put pressure on the League to approach the Security Council. It was they also who took the lead to sabotage the African Union's well-thought-out roadmap on Libya, which in retrospect could see to have been a better plan than the one which was adopted by the Security Council. The problem with the African plan for France and the UK and perhaps also the United States was that it did not request the removal of President Gaddafi and thus not in favor of regime change. We should also not forget the role of the three African members of the Security Council that approved Security Council Resolution 1973 in March of that year, at March 2011. These African countries voted for a resolution which ignored the African Union's roadmap and in fact praised the Arab League, a resolution calling for a no-fly zone. So this is what we have to bear in mind. What has become a pattern in the international community today is that facts don't matter anymore. But this is a very dangerous road to go. While we all have a right to difference of opinion, no one, no individual, no state has a right to create their own facts. And this has been the tragedy of Libya and the mess that we are now seeing. But the truth has now been revealed by the House of Commons report, and I hope all Africans will read that very important report. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, protect the flame of your candle and it will light some more. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Humanitarian response, peace and security, and countering terrorism and violent extremism will be top priorities for the United States as its delegates join those of 193 nations during the high-level week of the 71st session of the United Nations General Assembly. The United States remains firmly committed to employing multilateralism to advance its national interests and promote a more peaceful, productive, and prosperous world. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs Sheba Crocker said events and activities throughout the week will advance key U.S. multilateral objectives. Humanitarian response will be at the top of the agenda when President Barack Obama, along with leaders from Canada, Ethiopia, Germany, Jordan, Sweden, Mexico, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, co-host the Leaders' Summit on Refugees. The President's summit responds not just to the headlines of yesterday and today, but to the broader and enduring strains on the humanitarian system, said Assistant Secretary Crocker.
We expect that the summit will result in significant new sustained commitments to UN humanitarian appeals, expanded refugee resettlement programs or alternative legal pathways for admission, and new opportunities for refugees and their host communities to benefit from improved refugee access to education and to legal employment.
The U.S. will continue to support efforts to promote peace and security, relying on UN envoys to advance political tracks in Syria, Libya, Yemen, and other crisis-stricken countries. To this end, Secretary of State John Kerry will attend a Security Council session focused on Syria and will co-host a ministerial event on Libya, among other meetings. The U.S. will build on previous commitments to the UN peace operations, aiming to enhance the UN's ability to undertake conflict prevention, mediation, and peace-building activities, while at the same time promoting accountability for conduct for peacekeepers. The United States will continue to strengthen multilateral cooperation on counterterrorism and countering violent extremism, with emphasis on global initiatives to counter Daesh or ISIL, other violent extremist groups, and foreign terrorist fighters. We will also seek to enhance the UN's capacities to implement the recommendations of the Secretary General's Plan of Action to prevent violent extremism. The United States will also move forward with UN member states on a number of other issues of continuing importance, said Assistant Secretary Crocker. These include climate change, sustainable development, human rights, nuclear disarmament, and UN reform.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.